Hi, I'm Chris Irwin. Welcome to The Come Up, a podcast that interviews entrepreneurs and leaders.
I think we were foolishly so confident. We just thought, oh, we have a great idea, so that's going to be successful. Let's just quit our jobs and start this business. And like, didn't really understand that so much has to go right in order for it to be successful. And not only does so much have to go right, but it takes so long.
This week's episode features Adam Sachs. Adam is a true digital media OG, and today he works with some of the biggest names in Hollywood, like Conan O'Brien and even the Obamas. So we got a lot to talk about. We'll get into how he started a group dating website and then moved his family to India for it and then sold that to Barry Diller. Then we'll talk about how Adam joined as the CEO of Midroll Media and then orchestrated its sale to EW Scripts, one of the biggest deals in podcasting at the time. There's many other stories in between. Adam's a fantastic guy. This interview is a lot of fun. Let's get into it. Quick heads up that my interview with Adam was recorded back in January and prior to COVID. Where do you think your entertainment and comedy origins really start?
I don't know. I've always been obsessed with comedy from a very young age. You know, I was obsessed with Adam Sandler and then Jerry Seinfeld and Seinfeld. The show was a really important like part of my life. At one point, I think I could like recite every word of every episode of Seinfeld. I would just watch the tapes over and over and over again. And the same for Adam Sandler movies before that. Yeah, I don't know. I just always loved it. And the idea of having a career in comedy, I didn't really know what that would be, but I always wanted to have a career in comedy. And at points I thought, oh, maybe I'll be a comedian. I never really was, I think, talented enough to do that.
You know, I always remember you as being kind of like a class clown and very funny and very witty and always, like you said, citing these really funny like Seinfeld references and jokes for everything that we did. But it seemed like you started to take it more seriously when you're like, okay, I'm going to join the improv jam in Red Bank. When you started doing that, did that further solidify? You're like, yeah, there's going to be a future for me here. Or you're like, oh, actually, maybe this is not for me. This is harder than I thought.
I really enjoyed it, but I was also never one of those people who was like super comfortable on stage. I think what I realized after I started doing these improv classes at the local internet cafe. But I did love it, and I thought that the people around me were really talented, and I really, like, enjoyed that. And so, yeah, even going into college, I thought, oh, maybe being on stage isn't really for me, but maybe I can be a comedy writer. Maybe I'll write TV shows, like, you know, funny TV shows. And I did pursue that. I had a regular college education, and at one point thought maybe I'll end up going to law school and even, like, studied for the LSAT. That was sort of like a hedge, I think, because in parallel I had like a writing partner who I went to college with, Allie Horde, mm-hmm. who's still a good friend of mine, and we would write comedy scripts together.
Yeah.
And she was the more talented one. She went on to be successful.
I think you guys are both incredibly talented with great success.
No, she was really, really funny, and now she's a writer at Seth Meyers.
I remember Allie Horde. I think I was working because Adam and I both share Northwestern Wildcat blood.
Yes.
And I was working on a startup idea when I was in grad school there. And I think I had asked Allie, who was at Funny or Die at the time, I was like, oh, can you be a beta tester of my product? And she was always very supportive, and she was like, oh, yeah, we're using it. We're using it on set. It's super helpful. And I don't think they actually really did anything with it, but she was a great sport. All right. So, you know, you're at Northwestern. You decide that you're not going to go to law school.
Yeah.
And so instead of doing that, you decide to teach English abroad mm-hmm. as your first move right out of undergrad. And what was the reason for that?
I had a friend, Howie, who's a year above me, who he is now a lawyer, but he was also like, you know, not sure if he wanted to be a lawyer or what he wanted to do. And he went to Madrid and he and I were really close. We stayed in touch and it sounded really cool. And I didn't know what I wanted to do. I had taken the LSAT. I didn't know if I wanted to go to law school. It, in my gut, felt like I didn't really want to go to law school, but I wasn't sure.
Yeah.
And so I was just decided I'll just take a year and like go abroad and maybe I'll figure it out.
It's almost like, in a way, you know, a lot of kids now are taking a gap year before they go to school. But getting some like free mental space to be like, what do I really want to do? To reflect, be exposed to new experiences. And I think a lot of people should do that more often in their careers and more often in their life and don't. And I remember that you were telling our group about that. I'm like, oh, Adam is always such an ambitious, focused person. Is he already falling off like the wagon and the path?
I felt like that, to be honest. First of all, going abroad was a huge privilege. And like, I made a little money teaching English, but like not everyone can do it, I don't think. But it was like, I look back on it. And yeah, halfway through it, I was like, oh my, my friends are already like, they already have jobs. I'm really falling behind. What's happening here? You know, my college friends are like getting jobs at like JP Morgan or they're in law school or whatever it is. Yeah. And I'm like, what am I doing? I'm going to be so far behind all of my peers when I get back after this year. And that now looking back, like in retrospect, that was dumb. Like I shouldn't have been worrying about that because it was an enormously formative experience in my life because it was like I was able to, you know, see a lot of the world and meet a lot of people and just gain perspective that I wouldn't have gotten otherwise. And I still have really close friends from that period that like live in Madrid or live in Prague.
No, and that's interesting to hear that you had doubts during that period, but you know, at the end of your year of teaching English as a second language, were you starting to feel comfortable like, no, this was actually the right decision? Like, I've learned a lot.
Maybe. I mean, now I feel like it was the right decision. At the end of that year, I don't know. I still felt like I got to get back. I have to like, I have to get home and like start doing something so that I'm not the bum.
Yeah. Now, I think, and that's a theme throughout your career narrative, is that you've made decisions where I've looked at them early on and was like, oh, Adam's going and teaching, you know, teaching abroad. That's kind of a weird move right out of undergrad. And then, oh, Adam's, you know, he's starting a tech company and is applying to Techstars. What is that? Startups aren't cool yet. And it was always kind of like this contrarian approach where there was probably like, you know, doubt within you, but, you know, doubt within the peer group. But it's clear that all these bets have really paid off. Kudos to that.
Maybe. You're giving me a lot of credit. I don't
know. We'll see where all this goes. Okay, so after abroad, you decide to go to Sony.
Yeah.
How did that come to be?
You know, I knew people at Sony from my internship, so I reached out to them and I got a very, you know, kind of entry-level job in Sony Pictures Television in New York.
And did you feel that when you were doing that, because, you know, your career took a big turn when you started your first company soon after, or maybe concurrently while you were at Sony, did you look at Sony as, hey, this is, you know, this is something I want to invest material time into, or is this, oh, this is just a stepping stone and I want to get maybe that traditional validation of working at a big company?
To be honest, I think at first I thought, oh, I'll get my foot in the door of this like really great company. Everyone like that was a radio TV film major at Northwestern, if they didn't go into being a writer or director or pursuing that path, if they went into TV, the hot thing was like to go into development. Yeah. And I was like, I think I want to go into development. I didn't even know what it meant, really. I was just like, oh, but it sounds cool to like be a development executive. So, I think I applied for those jobs and couldn't get like I didn't get them or whatever. So I got like a different job in the ad sales department at Sony. But I think my thinking was, I'll get in the door there, and then I'll like figure out how to have a development career, and hopefully along the way I'll figure out what development means. That was my thinking.
Yeah. I think I want a development career. I don't know what it is, but it sounds
cool,
cachet.
And people who do it think it's cool. So that I honestly think that was my thinking at the time, and there was also always a New York LA kind of conflict in my mind. Like I felt like LA was in New York, but I did feel like LA was an inevitability at some point. Like if I wanted to pursue that sort of career. But at the same time, my good college friend and I, Dan Ossett, we started to talk about this like startup idea that we got that we got really obsessed with. And it was the idea of we were, you know, in our early mid-20s living in New York City and going out with our group of friends and going out and meeting other friends. And we started to think, man, isn't it crazy that there's no dating site that where like you go out with your friends and meet other people? And wouldn't it be like more fun and less awkward and, you know, even safer to have an experience where you went out with your friends and met another group of friends. And the more we talked about that idea, he was also, you know, in his first or second year of working in a finance job out of college. The more we talked about that idea, the more we thought like, this is a really good idea. And we talked to friends who thought it was a good idea. And I think I was planning to move to LA and, you know, move in with Matt and Rob and some of our buddies and just figure out like how to get a development job basically. And then, I became obsessed with this business idea and like this idea of starting a startup. And the more we talked to our friends, the more we got excited about it. And then we quit our jobs and we like started pursuing it.
So how'd you guys think about how to start actually building the company. Today, there's millions of guides for like how to build a business.
Yeah.
But 15 years ago, there was a lot less resources out there. So what did you guys turn to?
Here's how different the landscape was then. We sent an email, Dan and I sent an email to like all of our friends, like a blast email being like, does anyone know anyone who has ever started a company? Because we don't know where to start. And now if you did
that— I may have been on that email.
I'm sure you were. And we got like one response, you know, or like two responses. And we ended up meeting the guys who started meetup.com, which was a really good connection for us. But today, if you ask that question, like everyone knows someone who has started a startup, right?
But the Lean Startup, Four Steps to the Epiphany, like all these all books.
Yeah, exactly. And that stuff didn't really exist. Or if it did, we were unaware of it. It was like there was a less of a established path at that point because we didn't know what to do. We said, okay, we want to start this thing. But what we had literally just had to try to start taking people out to coffee to understand how do you do this.
Yeah. So what was the point where you guys made that decision where we're leaving our jobs, we're getting off this path to become development execs, whatever that is, or you know, financiers? That is a big decision to make at an early age. Also considering like what your peers are doing, your parents probably not understanding the opportunities within the startup space. What was that catalyst point?
I think we were, and to be honest, like foolishly so confident that we had a great idea. And I think because we knew so little about starting a business, didn't realize how important like execution is. And like we just thought, oh, we have a great idea, so that's going to be successful, of course, because our idea is great. And we've asked our friends and they think it's great too. So like, let's just quit our jobs and start this business. And like, didn't really understand that so much has to go right in order for it to be successful. And not only does so much have to go right, but it takes so long to like, you know, and it's going to take a lot of endurance. But it was not easy. Like my friends all continued on in their jobs in New York City. I had to move home. I didn't really have a paying job for a long time. So I like had to move in back in with my parents in New Jersey.
Yeah. I really like how you described that you had to be foolishly confident. I think when you do the math, the odds are totally stacked against you in starting a company. So you have to be delusional in a way and saying like, oh, I can do this. And so whether that's just like in your blood or in your nature or, you know, at your point, you just didn't even know any better.
No, I just didn't know any better.
That was an asset.
Exactly. I think it was truly like my ignorance helped in that way because I just didn't know any better.
I think I remember, so you used to host at your father's house in Little Silver. Mm-hmm. You used to host a lot of basketball games.
Yep.
You play a lot of like 3-on-3 or 5-on-5, what have you. I think we were over there one day, and I think I had heard rumors that you're like, yeah, Adam's like starting this company, and now he's applied to Techstars, and he's getting into this program. And I was like, Adam, like, I don't understand what you're doing. Like, I'm confused. Like, what is this? Startups weren't cool yet. But, you know, you had a mission, you had a plan, and so then you applied to Techstars. What was that application process like?
So we realized that we had to raise money in order to build this thing. And so we ended up meeting through friends of friends, some early stage VCs. They were rightfully, for the most part, like, you guys are not really investable at this point. You know, you don't really know what you're doing. And we hadn't really built much at that point. Well, but one of the VCs who really, I think, believed in us was this guy, Jason Mendelson, and his partner, Seth Levine, at the Foundry Group in Boulder. And we got connected with them. And they were also like, you know, you guys are onto something here, but you're in New York, we're in Boulder. But I think they really liked us and believed in us. And so they encouraged us to apply to Techstars. Hmm. And we had never heard of Techstars before. But they're intimately involved in starting Techstars and supporting Techstars. It was not an obvious thing for us to do, because I had never heard of it. I didn't know what a, you know, incubator or accelerator was at that point. Again, this is a different time where now everyone, like, there's a million accelerators.
It's crazy. And this was literally 12 years ago.
Yeah.
So it's not like, oh, we're talking about 35 years ago. No, this was like within generally the past
decade.
It was not
that long ago, but it was a different world. And so, yeah, we applied. And I think through the help of those guys, we ended up getting in. But even then, I think, again, points to our kind of foolish ignorance. We were like, maybe we're a little too far along for this Techstars thing, is what we thought. We're like, we have some users on in our Facebook app. That's how we started.
Okay. It's just also funny to hear, like, this speaks to the delusional part of, actually, we're pretty advanced. Like, we have users, so we actually really need to be a part of this program.
Yeah.
Maybe we should just, like, skip this.
Yeah.
That's funny.
Again, pretty dumb. But it was a really, really a valuable experience. Like, you know, it's a mentorship-driven experience. We needed mentorship. You know, I studied history and film in college. Dan, I think, studied communications or something. We didn't really know what we were, you know. And also, there's really not a great curriculum, probably even to this day, for starting a company. In my opinion, like, you have to talk to people who have done it. learn from people who have done it. I think it's not something that you graduate, even if you, I know very few schools have like an entrepreneurship program, but I think even if you graduated with a degree in entrepreneurship, like you still don't really know what you're doing until you get in there and start doing it.
Yeah. So you're at TechStars. Clearly was a positive experience. You graduate.
Yes.
And then did you raise money immediately upon graduation at Demo Day?
Yeah, immediately. We had a really good presentation, actually. We were working with our mentors. And again, these guys, Jason and Seth, that Foundry Group became our mentors. And the second half, really, of TechStars is like for preparing, at least at this point. I don't, it might have changed. Again, this is 2008, so this is a long time ago. But at that point, like the first half is a lot of mentorship. The second half is really like preparing for Demo Day.
Yeah.
And I remember we like put together a presentation that we, a draft of a presentation. We brought it over to Jason in his office and sat down with him and walked him through it. And he was just like, yeah, it's pretty good. I don't know. It's like, it's fine. But like, it's missing like you guys is like what he said. And I think he'd gotten to know us and like know our personalities or whatever. And we went back and I remember like we locked ourselves in a room with our small team of four of us for like a weekend and came back to him on Monday. And it was a funny presentation. Like it was like a comedy driven presentation. And he was just like, this is it. Like this is it.
So I never thought about that, but thinking about your roots in comedy, entertainment, improv, and then, you know, writing with Ali at Northwestern, pitching to an investor is about telling an incredible story of excitement, why we are the best team to do this, really piquing their interest. And I was like, you have like the formula for that. And I guess that's what this guy wanted.
Yeah.
And then he didn't know what you had in you. And you're like, no, like, let us show you.
Yeah. And so the presentation went great. And I think, you know, for a lot of people, it was a lot of the VCs, there's 300, you know, VCs in the audience or something like that. I think for a lot of them, it was the first time they saw like a actual like funny VC pitch or whatever, like startup pitch.
Yeah.
I don't think it was necessarily like the humor that attracted that, like any smart VC is not going to be like, I want to invest in the funniest entrepreneur. On the surface, it was funny, but like when you got beneath it, it was like, oh, these guys actually know, like they have a good handle on what their like vision for the business is.
Yeah.
So yeah, we did raise money immediately.
An interesting highlight from that point though is, I think what investors see for like an early stage company is, okay, do they have a product? Have they built something? Are they solving a real problem? But it's so early, even if they have a little bit of users, it's likely pre-revenue. So there's just an incredible amount of risk.
Yeah.
So they're really betting on the founders.
Yeah.
On the ability of the founders to, you know, attract future capital, tell a good story, recruit a team and build a team and motivate people. And so what they could have seen in you is like, okay, there's this magnetism of this team that's going to be able to attract people to their team and get them excited about this ridiculous mission that they're on. So it seems like, yeah, this asset of your storytelling was actually like checking a major box for these investors if you think about it that way.
Yeah, maybe. We also rushed the fundraising process because this was like August, September of 2008 and the financial world was starting to just collapse around us. And so once we saw that happening, we were like, you know, we were pushing our investors to like, get your checks in. We knew that like very shortly after that, we could feel like the economy was collapsing.
Got it. So money comes in the bank. And how much did you raise initially?
So funny. Again, only 12 years ago, but we raised a Series A and it was like $1.2 million, which today is like a pre-seed amount of money. But at that point, that was our Series A.
Okay. And that was on top of a little bit of family and friends money that you had raised?
Yeah. Yeah.
Got it. So you have the money. Your team is feeling excited. You moved to New York City. I remember that you had offices in Union Square. I don't know if you moved immediately there.
Yeah, we did.
I was part of a beta test for a group date in the Lower East Side.
Yeah.
I remember.
I think we went to Max Fish or something like that.
Yeah. There was like six or seven guys, or seven girls. We're all competing to say who's getting the most amount of FaceTime with the other side. And it was a really funny experience. There was also a launch party that was associated with it.
Yeah, at Barna, which no longer exists on Park Avenue South. Yeah.
So I remember I was like, okay, I don't know what Adam's doing, but if I get invited to cool parties and get to go on like group dates and maybe meet women, like, I'll be supportive. all right, so tangent. You're in New York City, you have the company, and now, you know, you're there for the next 6 years. What do you remember as like a major inflection point after raising that money and saying, okay, now we're scaling this company? What were some of those key milestones?
I mean, one of them for sure, the biggest one for sure is we were out there hustling, having parties. You know, we would literally like throw a party at a bar in the East Village, bring our digital cameras, because that's how you took pictures then, and computers, and like buy people drinks to like sign them up in exchange for like having them have a profile on our site. So we'd be like, hey, do you want to like try our site? We'll buy you a drink. And and so we would like then take their picture at the bar and like make a profile for them. So it was like, it was a grind to get people to sign up.
And were most people amenable to that, or were some people turned off?
Half and half, okay. I think. You know, we had like maybe dozens of people like signing up every day in, wow, in New York. But we'd go home at night and like look at our Google Analytics and be like, oh, hundreds of people signed up today in India. Or like, thousands of people signed up today in India at one point. And so that was sort of the inflection point, which is like we're pushing too hard for something that maybe there's not as much of a demand for here as there is for other places. And so at that point, it was like, let's understand this. What is going on here? We didn't understand India or some of the other markets where we were seeing this natural, you know, like organic demand. And yeah, India was one of them for sure. Also like Singapore and Malaysia and Indonesia and other Asian countries. And so at that point, it was like, that was a huge inflection point. It was, let's understand what's going on here so that we can decide, is this worth pursuing?
We're back from a quick break, and maybe unbeknownst to Adam, but I just actually, we have a bunch of our high school friends on group text, and I just sent a crowdsourced message of any questions that we should ask Adam on the podcast. So I might check this at the end when we get to the rapid fire. That has been seated within the group, so we'll see what happens.
Our friends are deviants. I don't want to see what their questions are.
So we were just talking about, you're now in New York City with funding, you're scaling Igniter, you know, you're hustling, you're grinding, you're going out to the bars, you're signing up people like on location. So then what you were just touching on, which is interesting, is this theme of the unexpected. So you're building this business, you're looking at your metrics, and all of a sudden you're seeing user growth in India and in Singapore and these Asian countries. That's not what you were necessarily intending for, but it's happening. So as you start seeing this information, you know, there's certain types of leaders and people that will say, oh, that's, you know, that's interesting, but we're not going to do something about it. What was the point where you're like, oh, this is meaningful, and now we're, you know, we're actually going to pursue this. This is opportunity. What was that decision-making process
like? Yeah, at first it was like, this is interesting, but it's not our mission, so we ignored it for, I don't know how long, for maybe a few months. And then eventually it was like the discrepancy between how hard we were hustling and grinding to sign up users one at a time in New York versus literally, I think at our peak there were like 5,000 people a day signing up in India.
Wow.
And it was like, what are we doing here? Let's figure this out. You know, what is it that's making it click there? And that's when we started to talk to people who knew the market way better than we did, talk to people who knew the culture better than we did.
And so like, how do you do that? Who do you talk to? Like the same thing, like figuring out who do you talk to about Techstars. Did you call up your investors? Did you call up friends?
We did. It was a little bit of both, yeah. And we were able through our investors and through the Techstars network to meet people who were either entrepreneurs who had like, who were maybe of Indian descent and had family in India, or who had family that were building companies in India. We actually shared an office with a company, coincidentally enough, called Exclusively.in. I don't know if they exist anymore, but they were a company that was building like fashion products in India. And wow, so they were really closely connected to the market. And so they started to like help us and connect us to angel investors in India and VCs in India, and those people helped. Once we like had, we started to understand this, we went out and we raised more money from investors who were interested in that path, in pursuing that like India
story. In growth in the Indian market.
Yeah.
Okay. And how much money do you raise at that point?
I think like maybe $3 or $3.5 million, something like that.
Okay. And are you, at this point, are you feeling excited? Like, hey.
Yeah,
like,
excited but scared too. Okay. We'd never even been there at that point. We still hadn't even been to India. It was hard enough, I think, building a company like in a market that we knew inside and out. And so the idea of building a company somewhere else felt like, oh, how is that going to work?
I can understand the mix of emotions, because maybe there was some frustration with the challenge in getting traction in the United States where you were focused. So this is in a way maybe a bit of a lifeline.
Yeah, it felt like a lifeline, but it also felt like we were riding blind a little bit too. Like our first move was like, well, let's just like, now that we know we have all this traction in India, let's put up a landing page so that only people in India see, that like shows people that look like they're in India and not people that look like they're in New York, so that, you know, and you could kind of geo-target in that way. But we didn't know the market well. So, like, I remember our first landing page in India, we were like, these are two beautiful looking, you know, Indian people. Let's put them on the landing page. And it turned out we put a picture of like a bride, like a woman wearing a bride's outfit. And we were trying to be like the antithesis of like one of those like serious like marriage dating sites. And it was like literally a woman in bride garb. And then, it was one of our investors who I guess knew the market was like, what are you doing? Like, that's not what you guys are.
Yeah,
you
know, your brand.
Yes, and that's so off brand. So it took us a while to figure it out.
This all leads to a point where you end up moving to India.
Yeah.
And you move there with your wife, Molly.
Sort of. We had an apartment in New York where we lived, and then I got a place in India. And mostly it was me going over there. Molly did go.
Yeah.
But it was mostly me going by myself.
Is there one memorable moment of like, you're in India and you're just like in shock, being like, wow, this is just feels so different?
I think just in general, just like the business norms were really hard. Like when we wanted to start processing payments, for example, I remember we had to like get some kind of certification from like the Royal Bank of India or something. Like, and that took forever. And we had to be compliant in a certain way that I like didn't really understand. And at one point I was like really an expert in all this stuff. And I've fortunately since forgotten, I think, most of it. But it was like very hard. And also people didn't really have credit cards. So you had to, or a lot of people didn't have credit cards. And so you had to figure out like other ways to pay. And there were people that were paying with like their mobile phone credits. And it was very, very different and in that way challenging.
Got it. So then you eventually sail to Barry Diller's IAC.
Yeah.
How did that come to be?
Well, to be honest, there's just not, and this is something that they don't really tell you when you start a dating site, is that there's like not that many buyers out there for dating sites. There's like one universal behemoth in the dating world that wants to be the globally dominant business, and that's IAC.
Yeah.
So, you know, a typical sales process would have like competitive nature attached to it, where there's like a bunch of different companies bidding for your business. Mm-hmm. It was hard for us to drum up a competitive process when there's like really just one buyer out there.
So you sail to IAC, and then at that point, I think that was a big milestone because you started a company, you ran it, built and scaled a team, transitioned to an international market, and then you exited it. And, you know, I don't believe this was like a major liquidity event for you, but it was a sale. And that is a big stamp of approval. And so now it's kind of like you have, you know, this big entrepreneur stamp on your back. And so next, I think that you ended up going to Midroll Media. Mm-hmm. And this is another major inflection point in your career where you're now, you kind of like lay the foundation for becoming this like early and seasoned audio executive in this now like fast growing industry. What sold you on going into podcasts and audio and then moving to LA?
First of all my time spent on planes, you know, going back and forth from Newark to Mumbai and then being in Mumbai by myself, I had become obsessed with podcasts.
Yeah.
I was listening to them all the time. They were my companion, you know, in India, basically.
Okay.
And I, as we have already established, like always wanted a career in media. I've joked, like I've studied radio, TV, film. I never thought I would be doing something in like the radio piece of it or like the R piece of the RTVF because that wasn't even really part of the curriculum. But yeah. I became obsessed with podcasts. I met a guy named Jeff Ulrich who started Earwolf. In fact, Ali Horde introduced us. And I met him when I was still at Igniter Step Out. And we just met as two like CEOs kind of commiserating as startup CEOs often do about like the various challenges. But I really like loved his business, even though it was still small at that point, it was bootstrapped. So he didn't have investors and it was profitable and it was growing. And it was in an area of media that I loved and that I felt like was just kind of getting started. So yeah, we got to know each other. And then the timing worked out that after we sold to IAC, he reached out saying like, I'm looking for someone to help me build this business. Like a COO type, do you have anyone in mind? And I was like, I'll throw my hat in the ring. And then also the other piece of it was that we at this point had like a baby in New York City and we were feeling like kind of done with New York. Like it was hard to have a kid in New York. I think the suburbs didn't really appeal to us. As I mentioned, like LA always had some certain like draw. We didn't necessarily know that we wanted to like leave New York and go to LA, but this was just felt like the right opportunity to try it.
It's interesting. It feels like it's checking a few boxes for you because I know in talking to you at that time, I think you had a really great experience at Igniter. You learned a lot. You built a great investor network. But it was challenging. You know, you had, with investors, a lot of different stakeholders in your business, different points of view, weren't profitable and like sustainable and like for a lot of the stage of the company. So Adam, you have a really exciting run at Midroll before you exit a couple years later.
Yeah.
You joined as COO and then in just 9 months, you're promoted to CEO. So tell us about that journey and what did you first focus on when you joined the team?
I mean, it was a lot. We were building this new network called Midroll. The business started as Earwolf, and the new thing, and that was continuing to grow. But the new
Earwolf was a network of comedy podcasts.
Correct. Okay. Yeah. But the new thing that we were building, which we saw as our real growth opportunity, was Midroll. And Midroll is what connects podcasters to advertisers. That really hadn't been professionalized at that point in the industry.
Yeah.
But as the industry was growing, it was like more and more podcasters wanted to make money, obviously. And advertisers were starting to realize that podcast listeners are passionate and they develop this, you know, intimate relationship with the podcaster. And so podcast ads could be very powerful in that way. Mm-hmm. And so that's where we saw a really big opportunity and started to invest a lot. It grew very quickly.
It's interesting to hear the timing of that because it reminds me when I was at Big Frame, which was we were creating short form social content online and managing digitally native creators, people that were on YouTubers, people that are on Facebook, on Instagram, etc. And a big part of our growing business was connecting marketers and advertisers with our talent. Mm-hmm. And so that's a very similar dynamic to what was happening with you. Okay, so you're leaning into that. And then did you know that within like 9 months that, hey, it's like, yeah, the CEO is in my orbit or it's going to happen? Or was it kind of just bestowed upon you?
No, it was, that wasn't the case. I think it was, you know, we were growing quickly, trying to add people quickly. The business started in a very, you know, it's credit to Jeff, but in a very scrappy way, mm-hmm. you know, adding more people and elevating the early people who had really done a great job. And I honestly think that the business got to a point where it was like ready to go to a different level, right? Like there was this scrappy level. And I think once it was ready to go to that growth level, Jeff kind of felt like it was better handled if I were in the day-to-day of mm-hmm. it all. And we didn't have a board, which was great. And another thing that really appealed to me. And so like Jeff and I were the board, basically. And
just
so
we made fast decisions.
Yeah, we were able to make really fast decisions. And so he didn't, you know, he was still, you know, involved in the business, but not in the really in the day-to-day.
I just want to quickly pause here. I think there's a good takeaway for our listeners that explains your rapid rise at Midroll. So I've worked with you and known you for many years, and you've also developed an industry reputation with many others that you're a very clear thinker and strategist, and that you have a point of view on market opportunity, you do a quick pros cons analysis, and then you make a swift decision to move forward. And then on top of that, you also have this great magnetism that allows you to build teams and rally smart people around you. I believe that this has caused success throughout your career and is really powering your growth now at Team Coco, which we'll get into in a little bit. So I just wanted to call that out quickly.
I appreciate it.
So now you're CEO. And mm-hmm. as we've talked about, like I think because I was COO at my last company and we used to joke that COO is like, hey, you have a lot of responsibility. You're essentially running the company, running the team, but the buck doesn't stop with you. Yeah. Like if there's a really tough decision to make, you're like, oh, that's the CEO or that's the founder. Like that's not me, that's them. So you get to be like everyone's best friend.
Yeah, COO is secretly like the best job in the world.
100%. So now that changes for you. Yeah. Now you're the CEO. The big decisions really fall on you. How did that transition feel?
A little bit scary. It honestly, one of the reasons it was scary, and I had experience being a CEO because I was CEO of Igniter, so I knew what it entailed, but you know, one of the things that was a little bit like scary about it was actually that we had so much momentum. We didn't make this transition because like things weren't working mm-hmm. and we needed to try something new. Like that wasn't really the impetus at all. It was really about growth. And that almost like put more pressure on me. It was like, don't fuck this up, you know, because we have a good thing going and we're growing quickly. So that part felt scary. It was also, challenging to be a part of the management team. If you think there's like the CEO and then below the CEO, there's like, you know, three or four like C-level executives. Mm-hmm. It was a little bit challenging at first or scary at first to be one of those like three or four people on the management team who then became the CEO and had to manage the people who were, you know, my peers are on that same level as me. So that part is like intimidating at first. I think it certainly didn't come without any growing pains, you know, that would never happen, but it worked. Yeah. It worked enough.
That's a very interesting call out. When you started Igniter, and, you know, essentially it's nothing.
Yeah.
And so there's like nothing to lose. Yeah. Right? It's like you're at zero and, you know, there's all this upside potential. And you're like, all right, let's see where we can take it. But now you go to this company that was founded by someone else that has some like real momentum and traction, and the reins are given over to you. That's a totally different responsibility set or feeling.
Yeah.
Clearly great experience. So now you're the CEO, and it's funny, at this time, this is also people what we're calling, this is peak podcast.
Yeah.
Right? This, I think, is around 2014. And so I think there's a chance for a liquidity event.
Yeah.
There's a chance to sell a company. What was the impetus for that sale?
It was a couple things. It was the first thing that you said, which is like podcasting was having a moment. Yeah. You know, Serial came out and Gimlet launched, and suddenly, you know, a bunch of media companies were saying like, we have to figure out what's our podcast strategy. And so we started to get a lot of inbound interest from both investors and potential acquirers. And having, like you said, been so excited about not having investors, and we were profitable and growing quickly, I didn't – personally, I didn't want to bring on investors, and I think the team agreed. We didn't need it, so why bring in other people to like just start, you know, having their own kind of agendas? But we did feel like if there was the right buyer, it should be something worth pursuing, at least having the conversations. You know, it was like because we were bootstrapped – was owned by a few of us, the business. So like we could have a meaningful outcome, you know, potentially without the number having to be astronomical. And so that's, and we also didn't, we thought, you know, who knows, maybe this is just the first wave and it goes away forever. And so we didn't want to miss out on podcasting's moment if like, if something new came along. And then the other piece of it is that there was money flowing into the space competitively. And so it was like, if we were determined to stay bootstrapped and we didn't want to raise money, well, people around us were raising money. And, you know, what does that mean from a competitive landscape? So that was like all the things we were thinking about at that time.
It was a beautiful moment to sell. Oh, I think the timing was great. And I remember when I was at Big Frame, this is just after we had sold Awesomeness TV, and I was in the offices, at our offices at Bunyan Olympic. I remember you calling me like late night, like 6 or 6:30 p.m. and we spoke for like an hour, hour and a half of like the pros and cons of a sale.
Yeah.
And how do you manage a sale process?
Yeah.
Because there was a lot that you were thinking through, and I could tell that this was a big decision you were taking very seriously.
Yeah.
And that you were excited but also scared at the same time.
That's totally true. I mean, this was, you know, a 6-month process of going around and, you know, pitching the company.
Yeah. Which can be brutal because the moments are, this is great, we're headed in a great direction, but this could also fall apart at any moment.
Yeah.
Like, you know, there's an investor that's excited, but then in the middle of doing diligence, maybe it all goes away and we miss our moment.
Yeah, exactly.
It's like on edge the whole time.
For sure. And, you know, and I think we were worried that if that were to happen, like we did have such great business momentum, if that were to happen, would that kill our business momentum? You know, would that kill everything? It felt a little risky at the time.
Unique moment that happened where I think as you were talking to different prospective buyers, you had a conversation with Andy Redman, who was the president of Tornante, and who we also knew, who went to our high school, a year above us. And that there was a unique moment that happened at Spago. Tell us that quick story.
So Andy Redman is the president of Tornante. Tornante is Michael Eisner, former Disney CEO. It's Michael Eisner's vehicle for investing and acquiring companies. And when I came out to LA, I reached out to Andy, and we, you know, we hadn't stayed in touch really. Our families kind of know each other. We knew each other a little bit growing up, but we hadn't really stayed in touch. But I just like reached out to him because I thought he had such a cool job. You know, Tornante like acquires media companies and invests in media companies. They make content, like they make really great stuff. They make BoJack Horseman, for example, and like so they do that, and then they also like just bought a English Premier League soccer team. So they like do all this here. And Andy kind of like, it all kind of rolls up to Andy. So yeah, I thought Andy had such a cool job. And so we met, or we, you know, we had lunch early on when I was out here. And he immediately, I think, got interested in Idrill and what we were doing. And we stayed in touch. And then during the sale process, we, you know, we communicated. And he started to get excited and like, you know, brought us in for several meetings. And then one of them was a lunch, you know, at Spago with Michael Eisner. And this was, I told you the story because it was one of my like, you know, very like just surreal, you know, most surreal, I guess.
LA Hollywood moment.
Exactly. Where I was like, you know, at a table with Michael Eisner, who by the way is from Red Bank. I don't know if you know that.
No,
like, his whole family's from there. So we had this whole conversation with Andy about like, we all grew up in the same area and—
Improv Jam.
Yeah, he was one of the funniest at Improv Jam. Oh yeah, his yes-anding was incredible. And so we had this like whole conversation, and he was really excited about, you know, about what we were doing. And then like at one point during the meal, Wolfgang Puck came over and sat down with us at the table and started giving Michael Eisner a hard time in a playful way about building a house like too big that it was obscuring his view. And
you're just like, what is happening?
Yeah.
Right now?
And then like literally like at the next Sydney Poitiers at the next table. And, you know, that was all like catalyzed by Andy. It was a very funny thing because we grew up in this, you know, very small town that's seemingly very disconnected from all things Hollywood and literally geographically, like on the other side of the country.
There must be something in the water in Monmouth County.
Yeah. You know?
That's a really funny story. So you end up selling the company to EW Scripts.
Yeah.
You end up going over there and helping the company transition for a bit over a year.
Yeah.
At that point, you had, you know, we're talking about like, you know, you had the entrepreneurial stamp on your back from Igniter. And now you have, in the sale of mid-roll to EW Scripts, you have a stamp on your back as you are a legitimate audio executive. Podcasting and audio, digital audio, is a fast-growing industry. And Adam is a leader that has incredible relationships, has built an incredible portfolio of audio content while at Earwolf. You also were able to help build out the ad sales arm and build out this scalable, profitable business with a successful sale and exit. So you're now, you have this brand as you're an audio executive. And I think that's really exciting. It's really great. I'm also curious to ask, I don't know if anyone has asked you this, is that the brand that you wanted? One. And then two, did you feel that that could also pigeonhole you a bit? Where it's like, okay, I'm on this path, but maybe my career ambitions are a bit broader, you know, in entrepreneurship or in other areas of entertainment. What do you think about that?
It's a good question, and I'm sure I'm pigeonholed in some ways. Like, I'm sure people look at me for better or worse as an audio guy. I think a couple things. One is I do think there are a lot of things I've learned in building companies and certainly probably more specifically in building mid-roll Stitcher that are applicable outside of just audio. You know, here at Team Coco, we're building a digital media business. Audio is a really important part of it, but there are things I learned through that process that I think are applicable. But I still believe in audio in a way that, like, I think if I were pigeonholed into something that I thought that I wasn't super bullish on or that I thought was kind of lame, then it might be more of a bummer. But I think audio is cool. It sounds dumb, but like I don't mind that that's like my brand, if it is my brand. And I think it's allowed me to meet a lot of cool entrepreneurs and, you know, work with a lot of cool companies. And I still think that the industry is like in its early days. And so I don't mind that being like part of or all of my, you know, my brand.
Yeah. When people look at your career story, just, you know, even if just listening to this podcast, that it's very multifaceted. And then in entertainment, I agree, audio is not pigeonholing you because audio is just is a medium to express yourself and to create story, to share ideas and to create IP. And that can manifest in a variety of ways, whether it's a TV, film, or a theme park, or short-form social content. And you look at all the others in the same.
Yeah.
And so I think it's actually a really fun medium to play in right now because it allows you to experiment in a very low cost and rapid yet efficient way. And then if you want to go premium as well, like Conan Needs a Friend, one of the best performing comedy podcasts on the planet right now, there's so much that you can do. But just one aspect of a business. So
yeah, I agree. I love audio. So like I don't mind it.
Adam Sachs, tagline, I love audio. Awesome. You sell mid-roll to EW Scripts, and I believe the price point was somewhere in the range of, if there was like an earnout, maybe 55 to 65 million-ish in that range. Adam is nodding, so I think I'm in the right ballpark. So, like, after the sale, Adam has a lot of options. It's after mid-roll, you then go do a stint as an entrepreneur in residence at Chernin, the Chernin Group. You work with some brilliant minds like Jason Bergsman and Mike Kearns and the rest of the awesome team over there, Steve Cosneo, and I'm going to blank on a bunch of other names. You even start advising Higher Ground Audio, the production arm of Barack and Michelle Obama. There's a lot of different things that you can do. And I think, you know, some of the options include you could start your own company, start another company, or you could go work for a team where, and you actually end up working for Conan and Team Coco and overseeing his entire digital business. You know, in that moment, how did you decide what you were going to do?
The way you describe it makes it sound like I had a lot of opportunity, and I did, it's true, but it wasn't obvious to me what to do, and which is part of the reason I went to Chernin. I was just like, I don't have a ton of conviction around a business that I want to start. Mm-hmm. I know what it takes to build a business from the ground up, and there's nothing that I'm obsessed over right now that I just know I have to go do this. the idea of joining something that was early and interesting appealed to me. So my thinking was like, let me just go where there's really, really, really smart people. And to your point, the Churning Group, especially as it relates to media, has some of the smartest. And so spending a year with them, first of all, learning how to be an investor, which I had zero experience doing, really appealed to me because I wanted to just understand that world a little more. Meeting really smart both investors and entrepreneurs on the media side or in the media world was really appealing because I felt like it would help me just figure out what to do next. And with the Conan thing, maybe it goes back to this theme of like not overthinking it, but it was like this opportunity of, oh, you can work with, you know, arguably like the like funniest person on the planet who has a reputation for also being a good guy and a team that really like is filled with good people and that like each other and that have been around here for many, many, many years as he explores and they all explore launching something new, but with the added benefit of brand and this talent and this reach that's all here. Like it was kind of like, let me just see what happens. And, you know, as we've already established here, like comedy is very important to me. And there was talk of maybe starting a podcast network and that was appealing to me for obvious reasons. So yeah, it literally just checked a lot of boxes.
How were you first introduced to Conan and Team Coco?
Through Churnin. It was like, there was a connection between some of the people at Churnin and some of the people at Team Coco. And that's how I just like got to know them. And I did a little bit of consulting work to help think through this business plan. Because what it is Team Coco has existed since 2010. Will, keep me honest, 2010, yes. But it wasn't until a year and a half ago that there was like this pivot into building it into a full-on media business.
Yeah.
It existed as a really successful marketing arm that marketed digitally the TV show, the linear show. Mm-hmm. And that became its own business in a way. Like that, the marketing of that, the distribution of those digital clips from the TV show and monetizing them across YouTube and social channels became a business. And then that ultimately became the foundation for what Team Coco is today.
Yeah. Just to be clear for the audience, the tentpole format that Conan has is his talk show with TBS.
Correct.
Got it. So you're like, okay, this is like an amazing marketing arm, but you also had a point of view of there's a lot more to do with this.
Yeah, and a lot of that came from my experience at Midroll and Stitcher, but also the year I spent at Churnin, meeting a lot of what I thought were some of the best, you know, and most forward-thinking media companies.
In onboarding into Team Coco, it seems that one of your like first early projects was getting Conan's podcast network off the ground. Is that accurate?
Yeah, that's true. They had tried a couple maybe like pilots of a podcast. There was talk of doing a podcast. Conan was half interested but pretty skeptical.
On his podcast, Conan Needs a Friend, sometimes he'll make references to you as the executive producer.
Yeah.
He's like, yeah, I don't know what this podcast thing is. Is this even real? Supposedly we have downloads. I still don't know if there's money coming from it. I don't see it. Yeah.
I think now he finally gets it. But yeah, for a while he was very, even after it launched and was successful, he was still like, is this thing real? I don't know. Am I just talking? Am I sitting alone in this room talking into a microphone and no one's hearing it? But what's happened is now he gets stopped everywhere he goes and people tell him, you know, I love the podcast. So he knows it's real. Or it's like some massive Truman Show scam where everyone is just faking it and coming up to him. But yeah, no, he knows it's real at this point, which is good. And
considering he has one of the best performing shows, that's probably important.
Yeah.
I want to just like jump back for a quick sec. Was it hard to get the team's buy-in or what, like when you were getting recruited, was it like, look, this is what I want to do here. I want to build out a podcast network. And so when they brought you on, it was like, all right, we know what Adam's plan is. So if we actually bring him on as COO, like we're going to get things done. Or was it like an uphill battle?
We put together a business plan that included a variety of verticals, audio being one of them. I mean, it was like the digital distribution business, which is the core business. It was live events. It was podcasts. It was stand-up specials.
Yeah.
And that was part of the whole business plan that I, you know, helped put together. And there was buy-in on the business plan, you know, holistically for sure. I think what we've seen over the past year is that audio has become a major investment area for us. And it helps that Conan's podcast has done so well.
Yeah. And maybe you can also reference, like, look, if Obama's leaning into this, like, maybe yeah, this is something no, that you want to do.
Exactly. Now there are, you know, Conan is one of many A-listers or A-plus listers, like the Obamas, who are understanding this is a huge opportunity.
So now you have, you know, you launched Conan Needs a Friend, and there's a few other formats as well that you guys have launched. Remind me.
Yeah, we have several podcasts. We have Conan O'Brien Needs a Friend. We have The Three Questions with Andy Richter. Inside Conan, an important Hollywood podcast, are all unscripted podcasts that we've launched. We've launched two scripted series so far as well, one called Frontier Tween and one called Smarter. And those are scripted narrative audio podcasts.
And are those exclusively on the Luminary platform?
Those are exclusively on Luminary, exactly.
Got it. Thinking about 2020, how do you want to build out the audio initiative for Team Coco? Where do you guys see as more opportunity?
We want to continue doing both scripted and non-scripted. So far, all of our unscripted podcasts have been hosted by people like literally within this building. You know, Conan and Andy Richter and Mike Sweeney and Jesse Gaskell, who are both writers on The Conan Show. And so for us, and this is like a broader theme, just for us to be successful as a business, we have to expand our talent network, both in podcasts and in, you know, the digital video that we develop and in the live shows. Like everything, it can't rely as much as you have a huge competitive advantage when you have Conan being the center of a podcast, because not only is he so famous, but he's so talented. But like there's only so much scale you can get out of that. There's only so much you can squeeze out before he just like, you know, collapses or revolts.
If he's listening to this, it's like, oh, Adam's going to like squeeze more energy and time.
We talk about it. He and I talk about it a lot. He talks about it a lot. He knows that we push him really far. And he has an incredible amount of endurance, more than most people. You know, he does more than most people at that level. But there's only so far it can go. And so in order to be successful, we have to do more with other people.
Yeah.
That's a big theme for us.
Well, it's interesting to hear about the endurance, because I think I was listening to a podcast with him and Jimmy Kimmel, where he was just talking about how hard they work. Like they're taping a show every day, their talk show, and then just all the other content that they're creating, the short form formats for socials, for marketing, for their podcast. It's just a lot of work.
Yes.
So it's not like 9 to 5, Monday through Friday. It's like they're on all weekend working and prepping and writing and all of that.
Yeah. He works really hard.
Along with a great team behind him that works really hard too. Okay, last question on Team Coco before we get into the rapid fire round, and then also maybe do some crowdsource questions from our high school friends, TBD.
Oh, God.
Just any other things about Team Coco that you're excited about in 2020?
I think building upon the things we've already started is important for us, you know, like doing more live events, building on our podcast network, doing specials. We're making comedy specials for HBO Max, and hopefully we'll be making more content for other platforms. All that is, I think, exciting. We also are doing a podcast exclusively on Stitcher Premium's podcast called The Best of Conan Stand-Up, where we're taking 5 stand-up sets from every year dating back to the first year that Conan was on TV each year and highlighting those. So you can listen to – it's hosted by Lori Kilmartin, also here within our walls. She's a writer on Conan and a great stand-up herself. That show is – every episode is a different season of stand-ups from Conan. I think there's like opportunity for us in gaming potentially. I don't know. We're trying to expand.
Awesome. I think you guys have an incredible path forward. We are massive supporters of your business, as you know.
You guys are really helpful.
To close out the Team Coco narrative, I think, you know, one of the things that Adam brought up in that first part of the conversation was just what attracted to him to Conan was, you know, his sensibility, that he's this amazing, talented comedy writer who's silly and funny and smart, but that also like Conan is a good person. He's got good values, and he's built out a team, you know, that he really looks out for, that he really respects, and he's really set the tone at the organization. And I can say I was fortunate enough to get invited to the Team Coco and Conan holiday party at Yamashiro in Hollywood. And it's funny, as I spoke to Adam, and then as I spoke to some of his peers like Willie Navarre, I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right, Steve Beslow, and some of your other business affairs executives. They all said, yeah, Conan sets this really special tone from the top.
He does.
I was there with a friend of mine, Maya, and we felt that in the room. It's just like, we've gone to a lot of Hollywood parties, and I don't get excited by most of them, but this one was like, it felt different. Everyone was so open, and it was a really good vibe. And I think that really leads to a really compelling and special creative environment, working environment. And what I also heard from talking to one of the final executives there was that Adam is also a big part of setting that tone with the leadership. She made it very clear that, hey, you know, that tone comes down from Conan, but it is also very much embodied in Adam and how he runs the Team Coco organization.
Oh, that's really nice. It's Conan and Jeff Ross for sure. Like, you know, they really take care of their people.
All right, before we get into the rapid fire, I'm just going to check the text thread.
Oh, no.
Joe Venti asks, is this the rebirth of Ask Adam? Ask him to re-rate what dreams may come.
The Ask Adam was my column in the Tower Tribune, the high school newspaper.
Got it. Okay. I think that's the one that we'll take away from this. I don't think we need to go into the other ones. All right, so rapid fire. Adam, these are questions that you could answer very quickly in a few amount of words, one or two sentences or less. Here we go. Proudest moment / accomplishment of your career?
Conan's podcast, I'm really proud of. It's reached, you know, so many people. It's brought joy to a lot of people. It's brought a lot of joy to Conan, who, you know, says that he feels really fulfilled by it. And it's become, I think, an important part of his, like, I don't want to speak for him, but I think he said stuff like this when he looks back at, you know, on what he's accomplished in his career. I know that this will be one of the like more important special things that he's done. And I think it's really good quality. I think it's like it's a really great show, and it's because of Conan and Sona and Matt, and I'm proud of it.
Awesome. What do you want to do less and more of in 2020?
I am always pushing myself to think bigger and to do more bigger thinking and to do less in the weeds micromanaging. I think I just have like a tendency to do that a little bit, and it's not a great quality. And so I think getting more balanced in that sense, I think, is something that's important.
Entrepreneurial advice. What 1 to 2 personal characteristics primarily drive your success?
I think getting shit done. I think a lot of entrepreneurs sit around, you know, saying that they want to do something or that they should do something. And, you know, I think it's the ones who see success are determined to just get something done and also stick around. Like, you know, I think it takes a long time for a company to find success, and it's not always fun. But I think hanging in there is important.
And a quick side anecdote, we talked about this yesterday, but also you are not petty, you're not political, and even like you're telling a story about your wife who's like, Adam, I heard that you're taking a meeting with this man or woman. Don't you remember a few months ago that you had like a really bad encounter? And
yeah.
You're like, oh, I don't remember that. So
I think, I have a bad memory. and I think maybe it benefits me sometimes, but I'm not good at holding grudges because I literally forget if somebody like wronged me. and Molly, who is like my biggest defender, is always does like stick up for me and look out for me. And she's like, what are you doing? We hate that person, remember? And I'm like, oh yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
I forgot we hate that person.
Last three, advice for media professionals going into 2020. Quick words of wisdom.
Follow the money is one of them. I think, you know, a lot of media companies in the digital space have come and gone because deficit financing digital video in a way that isn't really sustainable anymore today. I think there's a lot of paywalls popping up, which I think is like in some ways a good thing, but in some ways a bad thing. Really understand what you're asking people to pay for, because I think media consumers are willing to pay, but only for certain things. If you're going to build a company in media, try to latch on to the best talent or the best content.
Smart advice. All right, last couple. Any future startup ambitions? See yourself starting another company in the near future?
Probably not. I mean, I don't know. Maybe. A lot of it comes back to conviction. Again, like also, I feel like I'm building a company right now, and so that it's hard to even have the mind to even find the mind share or bandwidth to be like, well, what else do I want to build? Yeah. I do a little bit of advising and angel investing, and that helps me to scratch that itch, certainly in not the same way, because you know, being on the outside is not nearly the same. But if I got excited enough about something, maybe.
All right. And lastly, people are going to listen to this and they're going to want to get in contact with you.
Mm-hmm.
What's the best way for them to reach out, develop a relationship?
They could find me on Twitter @ARSachs. Yeah, find me on Twitter.
Find Adam on Twitter. Oh, all right, Adam, thank you very much. This has
thank
been
you.
An
this
absolute
is great.
Joy
You're
and
a
delight.
Natural. You're a good podcaster.
Oh, thank you
I'm
very
much. I'm not surprised, though.
Thank you very much. Much more to come. I look forward to our next conversation.
Me too. Thanks, Chris.
Come Up is written and hosted by me, Chris Irwin, and is a production of Rockwater Industries. Please rate and review this show on Apple Podcasts. And remember to subscribe wherever you listen to our show. And if you really dig us, feel free to forward the Come Up to a friend. You can sign up for our company newsletter at wearerockwater.com/newsletter. And you could follow us on Twitter @TCUPod. The Come Up is engineered by Daniel Turek. Music is by Devin Bryant. Logo and branding is by Kevin Zazali. And special thanks to Andrew Cohen and Sean Dipp from the Rockwater team.